You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 7th of March 2024 on Monocle Radio. The Globalist, in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist, and I'm Chris Chermak. Coming up:
when America gets knocked down, we get back up. We keep going. That's America. That's you, the American people. It's because of you America's coming back. It's because of you our future is brighter. It's because of you that tonight we can proudly say the state of our union is strong and getting stronger.
Joe Biden's boisterous State of the Union address kicks off the 2024 presidential campaign. We'll assess the president's performance. Then Latvia becomes the first European country to ban agricultural imports from Russia. Will they be the last? We'll also look at the state of the ceasefire talks in Gaza, or lack of them, and after that:
today, there's incredible unity between Britain and Germany and France and America and across Europe in helping Ukraine to fight off this aggression with everything we can.
UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron insists everything is fine, just fine, between the UK and Germany on a visit to Berlin. We'll also have the latest business news and Andrew Muller's quirky take on what we learned this week. That's all ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has personally guided an artillery firing drill at the same time that military drills are underway between the US and South Korea. Hong Kong has published the draft of a new national security law, strengthening and broadening penalties for sedition and external interference. And archaeologists claim to have found some of the earliest ever cave paintings in South America. Stay tuned to Monocle Radio throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, last night's State of the Union speech in the U.S. Capitol was a raucous affair, with President Joe Biden targeting his 2024 election opponent Donald Trump, or his predecessor, as he called him, and at times practically goading Republican lawmakers in the audience to respond. After Super Tuesday this week, the 2024 general election now feels officially underway, and Biden, who trails Trump in a number of polls, has sounded the starting bell.
In January 1941, Franklin Roosevelt came to this chamber to speak to the nation, and he said, "I address you at a moment unprecedented in the history of the Union. Hitler was on the march. War was raging in Europe. President Roosevelt's purpose was to wake up Congress and alert the American people that this was no ordinary time. Freedom and democracy were under assault in the world. Tonight, I come to this same chamber to address the nation. Now, it's we who face an unprecedented moment in the history of the Union. And yes, my purpose tonight is to wake up the Congress and alert the American people that this is no ordinary moment either. Not since President Lincoln and the Civil War have freedom and democracy been under assault at home as they are today."
I am joined now by Scott Lucas, adjunct professor at the Clinton Institute, University College, Dublin. Scott, we heard some of the speech there with Joe Biden kind of putting this all into historical context. This is a very formal part of the U.S. calendar, obviously, the State of the Union. But how big a moment was this for Joe Biden?
Well, it was a big moment for Joe Biden, but it's an even bigger moment for the country. It's not just the fact that we're in an election year. We're probably in the most important election year in the United States since the end of the Civil War in 1865. I think Biden summarized it when he said, and it's not an exaggeration, you know, what you heard in that clip, that never before have you faced a threat to democracy to this extent at home and abroad. And I think he did three things, Chris, that were important in trying to address that unprecedented moment. First, he had to show energy, given the white noise around his age that's being whipped up, not just by the Republicans, but by an American media that has lost the plot. And he did that. It was more than an hour. It was forceful. It was impromptu at many points. He took on the hecklers from the Republicans, and he got a loud standing ovation for it. But secondly, more important, he had to highlight that threat that he talked about by referring for almost 10 minutes of the hour to democracy. And by democracy, as you noted, he kept talking about my predecessor, the threat that Donald Trump had posed to that, culminating in the Capitol attack of January 2021, and the threat that Trump would pose if he came back into office. And thirdly, he had to hit specific issues. He had to highlight specific issues, both for the campaign and for the future of America. And I think the key ones probably that came out last night was staking out ground on the economy, on education, trying to stake out ground on immigration, which could have been a weak point for the Democrats. And most importantly, because I think this could be the number one issue in the election, women's rights and abortion rights in particular.
Well, we'll get to some of those. But Scott, as you mentioned, he talked about the threat both at home and abroad to democracy. We'll maybe take those a little bit in turn. Joe Biden did start his speech with Ukraine. Let's hear a little bit more of that.
Assistance to Ukraine is being blocked by those who want to walk away from our world leadership. It wasn't long ago when a Republican president named Ronald Reagan thundered, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." Now, my predecessor, a former Republican president, tells Putin, quote, "Do whatever the hell you want." That's a quote. A former president actually said that, bowing down to a Russian leader. I think it's outrageous, it's dangerous, and it's unacceptable.
Scott, in addition to the rhetoric there, I mean, this is also a reminder that we are not only in an election year, but there are important issues at stake, life and death, frankly, for Ukraine. What did Joe Biden do on that issue? Do you get any sense that he might have moved the needle on the funding that Ukraine needs?
He sent out what needs to be done in what you accurately described as a critical moment for the future of Ukraine, given Vladimir Putin's wish to conquer it, to subjugate it. Whether it moves the needle is very much up to the Trumpist and the hard right faction, especially in the House, that are holding Ukraine hostage, and indeed holding the U.S. hostage, by blocking the $60 billion in aid which the Biden administration has requested. And because the reason they're holding it hostage, the reason that they're willing to sacrifice U.S. foreign policy, is to avoid any kind of deal or any kind of, you know, advance before November. In other words, they have put the priority of Trump's reelection above that of Ukraine's survival. And, you know, you just have to see if the rest of Washington can come together on a bipartisan basis and finally overcome that blackmail.
Scott, on the domestic front, Joe Biden did tackle democracy directly, but he also tackled another important issue for the elections, which is reproductive rights.
And with all due respect, justices, women are not without electoral power. Electoral or political power. You're about to realize just how much you've brought about that.
It was something that Joe Biden leaned into directly, also specifically mentioning the role of Kamala Harris, the vice president. How important was that?
Let's link the two issues. And that is that threat to freedoms, that threat to the U.S. system itself, which was highlighted by January 6th, which was highlighted by Donald Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election, an attempted coup. Biden linked those threat to freedoms to the specific issue of women's freedoms. The question he put bluntly was, how many freedoms are we prepared to lose? He pledged to reinstate Roe v. Wade, a woman's right to choose across all 50 states. We will see specifically if that can be done with a new Congress in 2025. But yes, I think foregrounding the issue is important for the campaign. because, again, I think it could make the difference in many of the swing states if women's rights is the number one issue for a lot of voters. But he also highlighted beyond the election, this is a key moment, which is, well, let me just put it to you in a symbolic moment there. As Joe Biden was speaking, many of the women members of Congress, especially Democratic women, repeated a tradition they have done since 2017. They were wearing the white of the suffragist moment. A century ago, women had to fight. They had to sacrifice just to get the vote in America. And now the question is, will Americans stand up for those women who may have gotten the right to vote in the early 20th century, but face a threat to their fundamental rights in the early 21st century?
Well, let's hear, before we let you go, Scott, one more clip from Joe Biden, specifically on January 6th.
My predecessor and some of you here seek to bury the truth about January 6th. I will not do that. This is the moment to speak the truth and to bury the lies. Here's the simple truth. You can't love your country only when you win.
Scott, that was a particularly strong line, I thought, from Joe Biden, this idea that you can't love your country if you don't win, or only if you win. I mean, this really sets up also 2024 exactly. So before we let you go, I'm just curious if you could talk about that. This election could have potential interference. It will be a feisty one for so many different reasons. I mean, what is your sense there of what he tried to do when it comes to laying out that contrast with Donald Trump? Do you think he might have moved any kind of voters that were, you know, in the middle, or Nikki Haley voters, anybody like that, that might be sort of on the fence?
Well, Biden's message was, you know, we should be in this for America, but Donald Trump is in this only for Donald Trump. And, you know, the fact is that Donald Trump did go to great lengths. Not just lies, but a plan to try to stay in the White House, stomping on the Constitution, stomping on, you know, the American people to try to stay. Will it move voters? Well, you know, everybody will highlight the fact that Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee now. But on Super Tuesday, you know, about a third of voters in most states didn't want to vote for Trump. There are a lot of moderate Republicans who are very uncomfortable with him. That's why Nikki Haley stayed in the race for so long. There are a lot of independents who are uncomfortable with him. Will they turn out against Trump or sit on their hands in November? I wouldn't want to predict that. But what I would want to say to you is what was highlighted yesterday wasn't just campaign rhetoric. The decision that those voters make in November is not just one about who is in the White House. It is about the future of the American system. Because whatever you say on the individual issues, and we can debate those individual issues, there is one candidate who is there, who has pledged to uphold the American system. And there is one candidate who, while he was president, tried to tear down the system and has said that on day one, if he gets back into the White House, he will be a dictator. That's how stark the choice is.
Scott Lucas there, thank you very much for joining us. This is The Globalist.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
It is coming up on 9:15 in Riga and 7:15 here in London. There have been any number of sanctions placed on Russia by the West in the past 2 years of its full-scale war with Ukraine. But one aspect that has remained more or less untouched is agriculture. Today, the Baltic nation of Latvia will change that, becoming the first EU country to sanction food imports from Russia and Belarus. Latvia is also helping purchase additional rounds of ammunition for Ukraine. And I'm joined now by Ogis Libiatis, associate researcher at the Latvian Institute of International Affairs and head of news at Latvijas Radio. Ogis, let's start with why Latvia is making this agricultural move now. Why not earlier?
Hello and good morning. It's hard to say why it's exactly now. I think that we have to look at it in a wider perspective. If we see that there are agricultural and different kind of protests going on in Europe, and this wave of protests also came back to Latvia, and our local farmers are also getting more and more involved in all these processes, saying that they are being threatened by the situation when the probably cheap Russian grain, wheat, corn comes inside our country, and that makes our farmers less competitive. And if we see the data, last year Latvia has become the country with the biggest part of transit of Russian grain in Europe. And this has been a worrying sign also in the political levels. And the discussion started about possibility to limit this thing. And as we know, that European Union has in no way sanctioned agricultural or food products or their transit through the countries. And we actually can't influence the transit itself. But we can think about selling some Russian products here. Just after the beginning of the war, there were some shop market chains who decided to forbid Russian produced products on their shelves in the shops. Now we are thinking to widen this probably, and to also prohibit the imports of Russian grown grain here. If we see that this part of the imported grain and the share of transit, it's not very big, but it still can influence the situation in local markets. So it's from one side, it's a political decision, it's the question of ethics and morale, and from the other side, it has also economic reasoning for this.
Well, and I mean, you mentioned the protests by farmers across Europe over the last few weeks and months. I mean, a lot of that was also about grain being imported from Ukraine and some of the tariff-free imports that Ukraine is getting. That was arguably the focus, and that's a tougher debate, isn't it? Because one wants to support Ukraine as well. But when it comes to Russian imports, it is a bit surprising, isn't it, that this wasn't done earlier, given that there isn't really that moral question when it comes to whether to stop Russian imports or not, especially for the Baltic nations, but really for all of Europe. So what is the impact in that sense going to be on Latvia? Was there a reason in that sense economically for this not to be done sooner?
This is the tricky question. As you know, you probably have heard the saying that money doesn't stink. And for many years, we have been taught that one of the biggest advantages of Latvian geographical situation is our closeness to the sea and being in the center of traffic routes, train routes, transit routes from Russia. And as you remember, we had the period in history where we had to be in the part of the Soviet Union, and all the railway system was created to get the products to the ports near the Baltic Sea. Our transit system on the railway is very heavily dependent on the transit either from Russia, from Belarus, Ukraine, also from the mid-Asian countries, all the stans, as we call them. And this question is very painful. If the transit goes down, the money that we get in our budget also goes down. It is a painful decision. However, as I mentioned, we can't really ban transit as it is, because that is the wider decision of the European country. And if we say that these grain is being transported later to the countries which need them to prevent hunger, we can't be ones who would influence this wider discussion, probably. But yes, this is a painful financial thing which we have to say, but I think that more and more this ethical aspect is playing also its role, and this understanding that you can't play with your closest enemy, let's say like that.
And just finally, August, does Latvia expect the European Union to follow suit here? The Baltic nations, Latvia, have been sort of the most outspoken in pushing the rest of Europe to also punish Russia further and support Ukraine.
I think that, we usually say that we are a small country, but this our influence probably during the last few years has increased, because we are a direct neighbor of Russia and we feel it very directly. And our position is probably small, but first step in a wider discussion. And if we take into account all the disagreements also from the different organizations, farmers, agricultural, etc., in the wider European region, which is closer either to Ukraine, either to Russia, I think there is a wider understanding also in Europe that this is a tricky game and it's a dangerous game, and we have to change something.
August Libiatis, thank you very much for joining us. Still to come in the programme.
We have learned, basically, that the Labour Party are perhaps just the bass player out of Sleeper and the lead guitarist out of Shed 7, away from being able to have their conference dance played by the dullest supergroup since Blind Faith.
Andrew Muller's weekly roundup and business news also still to come. This is The Globalist. Oh my, shaking our heads at Andrew Muller here. Well, let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Phil Clark, Professor of International Politics at SOAS University of London. Phil, great to have you here.
Good morning, Chris.
Let's start with MH370, the Malaysian Airlines flight. Listeners at this point on The Globalist will be very familiar with this because we've been running a series throughout this week kind of looking at what happened. But today is the actual 10-year anniversary of the disappearance of that flight. How have the newspapers been covering it?
It's incredible to look at this coverage today, Chris. As you say, it's all over the international press. I think one of the themes through a lot of the stories today is the grief of family members who related to the victims of this disappearance have taken the search upon themselves. So story after story of loved ones combing beaches, hiring commercial aircraft and boats to go looking for the debris, because they've given up on any of the governments involved in this case re-engaging in the search. So these really harrowing stories of families dealing with what happened and trying to do it in this very devastating but practical way.
It is very interesting that we heard about that yesterday a little bit as well. That there isn't even like a permanent memorial, anything like that. Private memorials are held by the families. So just the role of the government is kind of absent at this point.
Yeah, I think doubly remarkable in the fact that, and I think I'd missed this detail along the way, that actually Malaysian Airlines was renationalized by the Malaysian government in 2015, because the airline had the double tragedy. They not only had this disappearance in 2014, they of course then had the MH17 flight shot down over Ukraine in 2015, and the company basically collapsed. The Malaysian government took the airline back into receivership, and you would have thought that, and I think there were a lot of expectations on the victim side, that might push the Malaysian government to re-engage in the search for MH370, but of course that hasn't happened, and you can see the anger from those families being expressed on the 10th anniversary today.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can hear our full series in a special episode of the Monocle Weekly coming out later. later today. Let's move on here for the newspapers to a couple of other stories. The European Union's refugee plans, not so different necessarily from the UK.
No, they look at absolute facsimile, I think, of the UK's migration deal with Rwanda. There's a big story in one of the Turkish newspapers, Yeni Safak, today, and I thought it was interesting to look at some of the European coverage of the party launch yesterday by Ursula von der Leyen, who, of course, is the European Commission president. She's the head of the European People's Party. They started their Congress in Bucharest, and their manifesto was launched yesterday. It's a centre-right party. It feels hugely under threat from various centre-right parties that will be contesting the European elections in June. And I think as a result of that, this manifesto is absolutely obsessed with the issue of migration. And von der Leyen is putting forward a European-wide migration deal to try to deal with the issue of asylum seekers that looks almost exactly like the Rwanda deal that the UK is trying to do. It's all about outsourcing refugee and asylum responsibilities to third parties, often to very poor global South states. She's at pains to say that she thinks it's fundamentally different from what the UK is doing, but I think if you look at the coverage, you would struggle to find any clear distinction between the two. So this does look like the trend in many Western migration approaches.
Absolutely. It's interesting. In this year of elections, we did just cover also earlier Joe Biden's State of the Union, and he sort of pleaded for a migration deal, but also one that is actually extremely strong in terms of shutting down the border. Are you getting that sense also here in Europe that this is kind of the way to go, that there's going to be a stop essentially to migration?
Indeed. It really seems that most powerful Western countries are saying refugees and asylum seekers are no longer our problem. We see them as an enormous burden. It's politically useful for us to weaponize this issue in the build-up to elections, and instead we're going to put the burden for caring for asylum seekers onto the much poorer countries of the world. So the UK, in many respects, has started down a pathway that is now being replicated by many other countries around the world.
Well, let's move on to another story, this time from Asia. Vietnam and Australia have reached a sort of interesting comprehensive partnership deal.
This is the front page news in the Australian papers today, and the ABC website's carrying this story very prominently. I think the reason this is such a big story is that it's the latest phase in Australia trying to contain China. That what Australia's been doing over the last couple of years is sewing up these strategic deals with a range of important states in the region. They did one with Indonesia last year. They did one with Malaysia as well. Vietnam is the latest. I think Australia and the US have been spooked by what seemed to be this closening, deepening relationship between Vietnam and China. That Vietnam and China signed a big deal about 3 years ago. The US and Australia have been on this charm offensive in Hanoi, trying to, in many ways, bring Vietnam back into their orbit. And I think that's the context around this comprehensive agreement that's been signed by the Vietnamese and Australian prime ministers overnight.
Well, and this agreement comes on the back of the ASEAN summit that was also held in Australia, in Melbourne. Just curious how also that was kind of covered in the Australian press. What sense you got? China was such a big deal there too. What the line for ASEAN was when it comes to dealing with China?
Yeah, you could see the ambiguity in the Australian coverage, which I think reflects the ambiguity in Australia's position. Australia, on the one hand, is trying to frame China as, you know, this aggressive global power that's breathing down its neck. In that respect, Australia is kind of towing the US's line on China. But at the same time, the Australian economy is completely intertwined with the Chinese economy. You take China out of the equation or you annoy China, then you risk losing these enormous mineral deals that the Australian economy has been relying on.
And Australia has learned in the past.
Completely. And our kind of diplomatic blunders have had enormous economic fallout in recent years under a couple of successive governments. So you could see that tension, that kind of schizophrenia in the Australian position playing out all the way through the ASEAN conference. And then you could see it in the media coverage as well. Some of the more right-wing papers were trying to beat the drum of this kind of anti-China sentiment. Some of the other press saying, yeah, but hang on, you know, we're being pretty hypocritical in calling China out on its human rights record because of these closer economic ties. So a real muddle in the Australian press over these kind of Asian regional dynamics.
Phil, just one more story before we let you go. An epic row over an epoch. What is this all about?
This is amazing. This is a great story, Chris, in the Guardian today, that there's a big fight over whether we are officially scientifically now living in the Anthropocene epoch. That there's a wonderful organization. I'm sure you've come across it. I'm sure you've been following this closely, Chris.
100%.
The Subcommission on Quaternary Stratigraphy, which thankfully goes by the acronym the SQS. And apparently
That's
this is the
easier.
Scientific body that determines things like what epoch are we living in. We've spent 12,000 years living in the Holocene epoch. There are many scientists who are pushing now for official recognition of us living in the Anthropocene epoch. And I guess the kind of serious bit of this is they're trying to say, well, look, you know, post-1952, which is when humans started doing nuclear tests, humans have had this profound impact on the Earth's climate. And so we need to recognize that with this official change in the epoch. Lots of scientists are pushing back about this, and nothing is more exciting than a major row in the footnotes between scientists. But there it is on page 4 of The Guardian this morning.
Major row in the footnotes. It's amazing how scientists can get involved in major fights amongst themselves about these kinds of things. Phil Clark, thank you so much for joining us. Now, here is what else we're keeping an eye on today. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has personally guided an artillery firing drill by the country's army at the same time that military drills are underway between the U.S. and South Korea. The North Korean drills included units in firing range of what state media called the enemy's capital. Hong Kong has published the draft of a new national security law that strengthens and broadens penalties for sedition, treason, espionage, and external interference. The Legislative Council began debating the bill on Friday, with many lawmakers expecting it to be passed next month. And archaeologists claim to have found some of the earliest ever cave paintings in South America. Some 895 paintings discovered in Argentine Patagonia are believed to go back some 8,200 years. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. This time last week, U.S. President Joe Biden said he expected a ceasefire deal for Gaza to be in place by Monday. That deadline came and went, and in last night's State of the Union speech, which we spoke about earlier, Biden sought to take matters into his own hands, announcing that the U.S. would build a temporary port off the coast of Gaza to deliver aid. Negotiations between Hamas and Israel do appear to be ongoing, even though there is no physical presence anymore in Cairo. The pressure is on to agree a truce before the upcoming Ramadan holiday early next week. Well, I'm joined now by Hannah McCarthy, journalist in Jerusalem. Hannah, great to have you on the show. Let's start with where these negotiations over a ceasefire go from here.
Sure. So Hamas withdrew from the negotiations on Thursday. They've left Cairo. The sticking point seems to have been, you know, the nature of the ceasefire and the withdrawal of Israeli troops from Gaza. Hamas have wanted a permanent ceasefire and the withdrawal of Israeli troops, whereas the rhetoric we're getting from the Israeli government is that an operation in Rafah is very much on the cards. You know, whether there is a truce now or later, they will be going into Rafah after that truce. So again, that seems to be a sticking point. But again, the kind of parameters of the deal seem to be agreed in the sense of there will be 40 hostages for 6 weeks. So I think what we're seeing is, you know, Hamas may feel that they have more leverage after seeing, you know, some of the reports that, you know, for example, Benny Gantz, who visited Israel recently and met with members of the White House. Israel is definitely under more pressure to, you know, provide more aid, to provide a kind of solution that will stop some of the killing. So Hamas may feel they have more leverage right now. It's hard to know exactly what their strategy is going into Ramadan.
Well, and these Cairo talks were always a little bit strange in the sense that for quite a few days now, Israel had not participated practically on the ground, but they were still involved. They've also demanded the names of hostages released by Hamas. That's been to be released by Hamas. It's been sort of a key demand of Israel. Do we imagine that that is even possible, that Hamas knows everyone they have?
Communication is definitely an issue, but again, for anyone who kind of remembers the negotiations over the last truce, this was also an issue last time, and the actual list of the hostages was just not released until, you know, the very last minute. So again, we probably would expect that to happen again. There are obviously concerns over, you know, which hostages, you know, are alive and who has sadly died. Because Hamas, again, after kind of various bombardment campaigns, they have said, you know, hostages have died during these bombing campaigns. But again, it's hard to verify that, and it's hard to know whether that's simply a tactic to ramp up pressure on Israel.
Now, as I mentioned, the US is also stepping up aid to Gaza from the coast, building this sort of temporary port. What's your sense of how much that might help the situation that is quite desperate in Gaza at the moment, possible famines, particularly in the north? And will Israel kind of cooperate or try to block this?
So this temporary port will take several weeks to build, and the idea is that it will allow several hundreds of truckloads of aid to embark at that port into Gaza, because only about 100 trucks are getting in on average per day since the beginning of the war into Gaza. Before the war, that was about 500 a day. There are concerns from aid organizations in Gaza that this is going to delay the flow of aid, that actually, you know, and it kind of distracts from the fact that your aid needs to be coming through the land crossings. And there are concerns that, you know, the building time for this port is going to, you know, lead to more deaths in the meantime that would be avoidable if, you know, aid was flowing freely through these land crossings.
Hannah McCarthy, thank you very much for joining us. You're with Monocle Radio.
Tune in to Monocle on Culture, where we grill our panel of critics to get the inside line on the best in the world of film, music, art, literature and more.
It's just got this synth section that kind of makes you want to swing through the saloon doors straight to the dance floor.
With industry insiders and the odd bit of reportage too, it's bound to keep the most discerning of culture vultures very well fed.
Why'd You Come In Here Looking Like That is a song that is absolutely going to make you want to put on a pair of tight jeans and go boot scooting, even if it's just in your front room.
Monocle on Culture, premiering Mondays at 20:00 London time and available thereafter wherever you get your podcasts.
It is 8:37 in Berlin and 7:37 here in London. The UK's Foreign Secretary David Cameron has been in Berlin meeting with his German counterpart Annalena Baerbock, hoping to secure additional support for Ukraine and playing down any rift between the two countries over the embarrassing leak of a German military call about Ukraine. The fact that he went to Berlin at all, however, would suggest this is one rift that did need mending. Quentin Peel is an associate fellow with the Europe program at Chatham House and is with me here in studio. Hello, Quentin. Great to have you back.
Good morning.
Lord Cameron spoke of incredible unity with Germany. What do we think went on behind the scenes?
Well, I think actually they probably did get on quite well because they're both coming slightly from the same position. That's to say, both represent governments that are in pretty good meltdown. just both of them look absolutely guaranteed to lose their next general election. So that means that they're in a similar position.
But united in loss.
But they're also in a similar position, really, on both Israel and Gaza and on Ukraine. Because on Israel and Gaza, they both represent sides of their government which is more critical of Israel and what it's been doing to fight Hamas and the desperate humanitarian situation in Gaza. And so Annalena Baerbock has been quite outspoken latterly in the German government in saying they must pay more attention to the humanitarian situation, and indeed so has David Cameron. So that's one thing on which I think they probably saw relatively closely eye to eye. More difficult on Ukraine because, as you were saying, there's been this in normal circumstances, wonderful scandal about the leak of the conversation between senior Luftwaffe officers discussing how and if Germany might ever send long-range missiles to Ukraine. And Cameron came out quite clearly saying, look, we do, and I think it's a good idea.
Do you think that moved the needle at all in Germany for Lord Cameron to say that? There is this debate, obviously, over these long-range Taurus missiles in Germany. Olaf Scholz, the Chancellor, has basically said no. Is there any chance that, similarly to in the past, Olaf Scholz says no and then suddenly says yes?
It is his character. having said which, he does seem to have dug in quite a long way, because what he's really scared about, I think, is that he'd be putting German boots on the ground in Ukraine to provide the guidance and the training on use of Germany's Taurus missiles. And he put his foot in it by basically saying, as did his Luftwaffe officers, of course the Brits already have people on the ground
very
there.
Helpful, yes.
And that didn't go down very well at this end. Now, both Cameron and Annalena Baerbock said very carefully they weren't going to comment on this. They didn't want to be helpful to the Russians who are trying to stir up division in NATO. And that's where you get this ringing quote, you know, that they are totally united. That clearly was to reassure people. I've been looking at the sort of public opinion in Germany a bit about support for Ukraine, and it's still pretty strong. Mm. I think it's rather more than 60% think it is right to send more arms to Ukraine. And of course, let us not forget that Germany is second only to the United States in the support they've been giving Ukraine, the UK coming in third. So I think that in the end, given that Annalena Baerbock's Greens and the FDP are both more inclined to give Ukraine the missiles that it wants, maybe Scholz will yet again do a U-turn.
Support for Ukraine, not so much support for the German government itself. We've heard on this show before as well that Olaf Scholz has basically been missing in action, according to some of the people we've spoken to. Is Annalena Baerbock kind of the leader in waiting? Is she the one playing this role now on the global stage that Olaf Scholz is not?
On the global stage, yes. And after all, that is her job. And look at the history of Germany. Foreign ministers are always very popular. Popular people. Remember the former Green Foreign Minister, Joschka Fischer. So that's always been true. It is extraordinary how Scholz leads from behind. Whether Annalena Baerbock is really a chancellor in waiting, her colleague Robert Habeck has been, on the whole, seen as the more likely person. But having said that, look, the Greens are on 14%. The Social Democrats, Mr. Scholz's party, are on 15%. Whereas the CDU, the centre-right Christian Democrats, are up on 30%. And worryingly, the AfD, the far-right, is on nearly 20%. So it certainly looks as if Germany, like most of continental Europe, is shifting to the right.
Do we imagine that since there were any conversations between Lord Cameron and Annalena Baerbock about what the future looks like if they are no longer in power, if there are other parties, how to secure aid for Ukraine, what other parties might do on that? Although there is, to be fair, a fair amount of unity between Germany and Ukraine and the UK on that.
Yeah, there's clearly a worry there. And I think what David Cameron said after their meeting, that in both of the major conflicts that we have at the moment, that's to say Ukraine and in Gaza, that it's really important to get those conflicts, if you like, in a better place before the American elections, because I think there is a real worry, both in Germany and in Britain, as what does happen to the transatlantic relationship, i.e. NATO, if Trump gets re-elected in America. And I think that is a concern.
And is that something, when it comes to defense specifically, was that something that was also talked about, this idea that Europe has to stand up for itself, increase its own defense spending, ammunition? There's all this talk about sort of the European military industrial complex at this point.
I'd be very surprised if they didn't talk about that. I mean, it's a real concern. Germany has been putting more money into defense. Notoriously, Germany's been way behind. Of course, if Germany starts spending really 2% of its GDP on defence, as it's supposed to do, that is one hell of a lot of money. I mean, German GDP is far greater than anybody else's in Europe, in Western Europe, and that would make a big difference.
Quentin, thank you so much for joining us. That was Quentin Peel, and this is The Globalist on Monocle Radio.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
It is time now to get the day's business headlines with Isabel Hamilton, senior reporter at The Daily Upside. Isabel, we'll start back with Germany, which we've sort of been talking about the political situation in the last item. But Germany is also completely gripped with strikes at the moment. Lufthansa, trains, everything.
Yeah, so it's a 2-day strike by ground staff, and train drivers are striking as well. The ground staff belong to a union called Verdi, and they're walking out for about 2 days. I think Frankfurt Airport is shut down. About 1,000 flights a day are being cancelled.
It is pretty extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, how much is this going to cost the German economy?
I'm not sure about the entire economy. Lufthansa has said it's going to cost them about 100 million euros in the first quarter of this year, which is a bit of a sting because last year they managed to rebound and have a really robust year, really big profits. I think they doubled their profits roughly last year. So this is a bit of a pain. However, I think it's not totally extraordinary insofar as last year, there was also what was called a mega strike where pretty much every transport worker went on strike. And that includes planes, trains, ports, everything you can really think of.
Well, and given that, as you mentioned last year as well, I lived in Germany for about 7 years, and there were always a fair amount of strikes in Germany, which sort of defy the reputation that Germany has, unlike, say, France, that it is efficient and doesn't necessarily strike. I mean, is that reputation for efficiency, is that buckling a little bit, would you say?
I don't know if it means they're not efficient. I think they just have very strong union laws, which mean that strikes are easier to kind of start up.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. That is one aspect of it. Well, let's move on to one other story as well that we're looking at today. Something from Tesla. Novo Nordisk's market cap has overtaken Tesla.
Yeah, this happened yesterday. So Novo Nordisk is the Danish pharmaceuticals company, which is behind Wegovy, which is a weight loss drug. It's become incredibly popular. Some of the listeners might know it as Ozempic, which is the version of the drug which is actually originally used for diabetes, but now the commercial applications have sort of exploded. And yesterday, Novo Nordisk announced that they're trialing this new drug, a sort of successor to Wegovy. It's a pill. And they announced that in phase 1 trials, this new drug was actually way more effective than Wegovy in helping people lose weight quickly. They saw about a 13% weight loss over 12 weeks for the participants compared to about 6%. For Wegovy, and you know, that just sent the shares way up. They hit record highs, and yeah, the market capitalization overtook Tesla.
It is quite striking that too, isn't it? We just forget perhaps just how powerful pharmaceutical drug companies are.
Yeah, and I think with these weight loss drugs, I mean, the popularity is absolutely exploding to the point where it's actually causing some problems. I was reading yesterday that there are nowhere near enough specialized obesity doctors to provide the proper aftercare in the US for people who are taking these drugs. Because in general, these drugs are pretty safe, but it doesn't mean they don't come without, you know, side effects. You might have to manage your dosage a bit, and there just are not enough.
And just quickly, Isabel Hamilton, one final story for you. We have about 30 seconds or so, but Chinese e-commerce startups are pouring a huge amount of money into digital ads.
Yeah, so a couple of reports came out yesterday that Shein and Temu especially are absolutely unleashing a fire hose of money on US digital ads. And it might be resulting in a loss for them. And it kind of shows how desperate these companies are to get US consumers totally hooked on their absurdly cheap products.
Very interesting. We'll continue to follow that as well. US-China relations, commercial ones as well. Isabel Hamilton, thanks so much for joining us. You are listening to The Globalist on Monocle Radio. And now, finally, it is time for Andrew Muller's roundup of the week's news in What We Learned.
We learned this week that the ambitions of Britpop are not sated. We learned that apparently not content with having dominated the British popular culture of the 1990s, the fleetingly charming but swiftly annoying genre appears intent on dominating the British politics of the 2020s. We learned that Dave Rowntree, out of Britpop titans Blur, has been selected as a Labour candidate for the Mid-Sussex constituency at the UK general election due sometime between now and as long as the Conservative Party feel they can cling desperately on four. And yes, we'll get this out of the way now. He is drumming up support, etc. Boo! But we learned that this followed Labour's selection for the Brighton Pavilion constituency of Tom Gray out of These People. I.e. not quite Britpop if we're honest, but near enough for the purposes of this bit, Indie Plodders Gomez. We have learned, basically, and trying to keep this slice of baleful whimsy broadly within the context of 90s-ish British popular song, that the Labour Party are perhaps just the bass player out of Sleeper and the lead guitarist out of Shed 7 away from being able to have their conference dance played by the dullest supergroup since Blind Faith. Yeah, I said it. I mean, just listen to this absolute bullshit. Fifteen goddamn minutes that goes on for. Where's the mallet? However, we learn that the Labour Party may at least have hit on a means of avoiding the common but ceaselessly amusing mishap whereby a given politician appropriates a given tune and then gets publicly yelled at by the artist concerned and or their representatives, which we learned is a mistake still being made by this guy.
People say, a lot of experts have said, the stock market's the only thing that's doing well, and that's doing well because our poll numbers are so much higher than Joe Biden's.
Sniffing a lot there. Still mighty chilly in Florida this time of year. The former and perhaps future US president has of late been fanfaring his appearances before crowds of hooting yokels with this song. I.e. Sinead O'Connor's spectacular 1990 rendition of Prince's Nothing Compares to You. Rebuke has arrived from the late singer's estate in the following brisk terms, as will now be read by our Rebuke's desk chief, Carlotta Rebello.
It is no exaggeration to say that Sinead would have been disgusted, hurt, and insulted to have her work misrepresented in this way by someone who she herself referred to as a biblical devil.
We'll put them down as a maybe and so forth. But we learned that at least one person did agree with the sentiment of the song in the context of Donald Trump, although it may not be unrelated to the fact that the person in question, Republican Congresswoman and idiot Elise Stefanik, is believed a contender to be Trump's putative veep. We learned that Congresswoman Stefanik, in addition to myriad defects already abundantly revealed, has a vanishingly short memory.
Are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? The answer for hardworking Americans across the country is a resounding no.
Congresswoman, 4 years ago, we could only leave our houses to brawl over the last roll of toilet paper. Still, we learned from the most recent primaries that the Republican talent pool has still further depths, as we learned that in North Carolina's gubernatorial contest, and yes, let's have another outing for our celebration of the word gubernatorial.
Gubernatorial.
I'll use that, yeah.
As soon as possible.
We learned that in North Carolina's gubernatorial contest, Republican primary voters had put forward for the governor's mansion in Raleigh this guy.
In 2018, Robinson posted that this foolishness about Hitler disarming millions of Jews and then marching them off to concentration camps is a bunch of hogwash. He also said the movie Black Panther was, quote, created by an agnostic Jew to pull the shekels out of your Schwarze pockets, using the Yiddish words for money and black.
Mark Robinson, for It Is He, is already North Carolina's lieutenant governor. So well done, North Carolina. We learned when we looked into it a bit further that Lieutenant Governor Robinson has other views.
Republicans in North Carolina have nominated a Holocaust-denying, LGBTQ-hating, gun-loving, anti-abortion extremist Christian nationalist zealot, who also happens to be a black man who hates the civil rights movement, as their nominee for governor.
And inevitably, one very prominent fan.
This is Martin Luther King on steroids, okay, now.
Which is about half right. We will trust the listener to discern which half. And
I'm going fishing, that's what I'll do.
In a world of trouble, strife, stramash, and widespread brouhaha, we learned that peace had broken out in at least one internecine conflict.
And we are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference and thus to contribute to assure the peace of Europe.
Something of that sort. We learned that hands had been clasped across the table in the New South Welsh settlement of Adaminaby, population 300, surnames 5, to settle a dispute about the colour scheme of a big fish.
What?
We learned that a weeks-long spat had been occasioned by a refresh of Adaminaby's contribution to the Australian cult of big things, the tradition whereby small Australian towns, which might otherwise struggle for a motif for the postcards, build an enormous statue of a banana, a prawn, a beer can, a cockatoo, a crab, a guitar, a galah, a cow. These are all actual examples. Or whatever. Adaminaby's big thing is a trout, but its paint had faded somewhat since its installation circa 1973. However, a touching up late last year had occasioned outrage with what was felt in some quarters to be an untowardly iridescent pink stripe. We learned that across Australia, people, or at least performative opinion honkers on little-watched cable news channels, had been able to speak of little else.
I think it's a shame. Look at him. He's loud and proud. I approve.
I'm sorry, but...
I know my vote doesn't count, but I vote keep him the way...
You've never seen a trout look that pink. I think I've got a shirt that's pink, but I've never seen a trout that pink.
Oh, newsflash, they're not trying to make it look like a real live trout.
Go for accuracy.
Please.
Accuracy.
But we learned that peace had broken out thanks to an agreement that another coat should be applied, and then everybody should have a bit of a think about what they reckon. Come on, rest of this anguished, querulous world. It's not that difficult. For Monocle Radio, I'm Andrew Millett.
I'll catch me a trout.
Andrew Miller, thank you very much for that very musical rendition of What We Learned. And that's all the time we have for today's program. Thanks to our producers, Vincent McAvinney, Lillian Fawcett, and Laura Kramer. Our researcher was Neoma Akwe, and our studio manager was Tamsin Howard, with editing assistance from Steph Chungu. After the headlines, there is more music on the way. The Briefing is live at midday London time, and do check out our series on the disappearance of a Malaysian Airlines flight MH370, out later today on the Monocle Weekly. The Globalist returns at the same time on Monday. I'm Chris Chermak. Have a good weekend, everyone, and thanks for tuning in.